This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 944. By the way, since you are listening to podcasts, I just want to share that Spotify makes it easy for you to stream this podcast and many others like it on your mobile device, desktop app, smart speaker. Just open the app on your mobile device, desktop, wherever, click the browse channel, and then click on the podcast section, and you can stay thoroughly entertained doing whatever it is that you do while you jam these podcasts into your ears. So thank you to Spotify for providing a platform for podcasters and also for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. I have some stand-up dates coming up the beginning of April. I believe maybe 5, 6, 7. But that weekend, that first weekend, I feel like I should know these things, Katie. Why do I not know my own fucking dates? But it's the beginning of April. I'll be at the Comedy Works in downtown in Denver. And then at the end of April, I'll be at Comedy on State in Madison, Wisconsin. So just go to the internet and get tickets for that business. What do you have on the corkboard?
Tim Robertson writes, I am an amateur astronomer and have been a member of the organization called the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers for many years. And in an effort to grow our membership and promote the group to a newer community, I've decided to do a podcast called The Observer's Notebook that highlights the activities within the organization. The Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers is an international organization devoted to the study of the moon, sun, planets, asteroids, meteors, and comets. Our goals are to stimulate, coordinate, and generally promote the study of these bodies using methods and instruments that are available within the communities of both amateur and professional astronomers. So again, you can find this podcast called The Observer's Notebook on all formats, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, etc. They have 38 episodes and they add new ones every 2 weeks. And then City Squatch, who's an artist, writes, I wanted to let everyone know about the fantastic free art community we have in the Atlanta area. We have so many artists that hide small free art pieces around the city and post clues on social media using the hashtag FAFATL, which stands for Free Art Friday Atlanta, but it really isn't limited to only Fridays. They said that Atlanta's community is one of the largest of free art contributors in the country. City Squatch says, I personally make Sasquatch-themed art under the name City Squatch. You can find my art under the name City Squatch on Instagram and other social media. And if you're in the Atlanta area, follow along for your chance to win free squatches or check me out on the hashtag FAFATL.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Katie Levine. This episode is Paul Reiser, who I wanted to have him on for so long. I mean, Paul is a guy who was a very successful stand-up in the 80s and also had a film career.
Yep.
And then had an incredibly successful television career with two sitcoms.
One of which was one of my favorite shows as a kid.
You're talking about My Two Dads?
No, Mad About You.
Really?
I fucking loved it as a kid, yeah.
That's fantastic.
I know, and my parents were always like, because, you know, it's about a married couple. I was like, what did I know about that? But I just loved it.
I try to talk them into bringing it back, like see where they're at now. Yeah. But Paul is actually promoting There's Johnny on Hulu, which is an interesting take on Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
And then Red Oaks on Amazon and Stranger Things Season 2 on Netflix.
He's all over the internet,
the Paul Reiser. Lovely man, and came to my house where we've been doing a lot of these podcasts lately, as we're sort of constructing the new podcast studio. This episode also brought to you by Squarespace. Destiny is calling. It says you need a new website. And if that is the case, if you are willing to take the call, then damn it, make it Squarespace. Squarespace will let you showcase your work, turn your idea into a website, blog or publish content, create a whole online identity that is not dependent on social media. You have control of it. You're going to get beautiful templates created by world-class designers, e-commerce functionality, customizable settings, everything optimized for mobile right out of the box. You can buy domains, choose from over 200 extensions, and then you're going to have analytics. They're going to help you grow that online presence. Built-in SEO, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and then 24/7 customer support that has won awards. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast number 944 with Paul Reiser. Katie, roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
And this comfy couch you're on belonged to my wife's grandparents.
Really?
Yeah. This is like a nice antique, super comfy.
In the old days, their asses sloped backwards.
Their backs were like this. Yeah. You know why? Because they had to work a lot with their hands and they just needed a fucking break.
Just how to get to this country, they had to have a sort of backwards tilt.
This reminds me of a bit that you used to do.
Are we going? We're talking.
This is happening.
What was the bit?
The bit... I think maybe it was at a Just for Laughs or something, but it was all about had something to do with like when you forget stuff, it goes over your head.
Oh, yeah.
When you remember stuff,
when you forget something, you have to look up.
We have to look up, and when you're trying to,
and when you want to forget about it, you look down.
You look down. Yeah, oh God, I don't know what I. What was that guy's name?
Yeah. What did I say last night? Look up. Oh yeah, there it is.
There was
a good bit. Why don't I do it and bring that back? Thank you. I threw out a perfectly good bit.
You did. You know, you might. That's what's so fun about stand-up is that you might have done. Who knows? I assume you didn't do that just once, but I did
that a bunch.
But there are probably bits you must have just done one time at a club, and someone said, "Oh, I love that bit that you did." And you're like, "What?"
Once in a while, there's something that now I'm going out again, and people will say, "Hey, I love that bit." And it'll be like, "Wow, I haven't thought of that because it was 25, 30 years ago." And one time, a guy came up and said, "I can do it," and he came on stage and like, "That's pretty funny." But yeah. When I started back like 5 years ago, I didn't want to use any old stuff because it had been done, but I just wanted to like start from scratch. So now when somebody brings up an old one, I go, you know, maybe I shouldn't be such a prude. That's that's a good bit.
I mean, that's what's great about having a comedy career that spans a big chunk of time is that you can go back and cherry pick some stuff.
Yeah,
you know, you could. My feeling is, you know, if you modify or you squeeze it into a new bit, then I think it's fair game.
It's like when people say something that they've said 1,000 times, they'll preface it with, you know, I'm fond of saying X, Y, Z. So I go, you know, I used to say, like, I'm already saying, this has been done.
I'm going to say it again.
But I used to.
You know, here's something I say all the time. Yeah. Maybe I should just say that. Here's the thing I say all the time.
And you're in.
And pretend like it's new.
Yeah.
When did you start? I mean, I was exactly the right age for that 80s comedy boom. Exactly the right age. So I watched everything.
The 80s comedy boom, you were a kid or you were in it?
I was a kid. Yeah, I was a kid. I was born in 71. So I was like, My comedy absorption happened with Steve Martin records in the 70s and then prior and then Carlin and just sort of dovetailed into the 80s for like the 9 comedy specials that were on every channel at all times.
Right, right.
So when did – you must have started in the mid-70s, late 70s?
I started I started hanging out in the clubs 77. Well, actually, yeah, I mean, full time. But when I was in college, which was 73 to 77, I would, in the summers, I would go and do it maybe once,
yep,
or twice. So that was when I first dipped my toe in. But at the time, my sort of motivation or my inspiration, in a sense, was the guys who had just launched out of those clubs.
Got it.
So you see Jimmy Walker and Freddie, yep, Prinze and, yep, Gabe Kaplan, and like, oh, so they go to this place called Catch a Rising Star, apparently, and then from that you get on Carson and you get a big show. Apparently, that's the,
oh,
that's
my God,
the pamphlet.
That was kind of the, that was an interesting time, because that happened in the late 70s and the early 80s, and then that started again in the early 90s, where they would give a stand-up comic a show when you know, right, like, it going into the 90s, then you had, you know, Seinfeld and Roseanne and, yeah, and Tim Allen and all those kind of started back. But they were doing that in the 70s, too, because of Welcome Back, Kotter and Good, yeah, Times. And,
well, you know, I remember when when I did Mad About You, it was like, yeah, Seinfeld was only like a year or two ahead, and there was Tim Allen and Roseanne, and then Ray Romano afterwards. And I remember interviews would go, why do you think networks go to comedians? I go, well, because they're making comedies, right? So who are you going to go to? You're not going to go to firemen.
Right.
If you want to put out a fire, don't call a comedian. But if, right, you want a comedy, a comic is a, and by the way, it's also historically, that's where TV started. You know, it was Milton Berle, and I mean, there were singers too who got their shows, but Bob Hope. I mean, the comics were the sort of lightning rod for entertainment.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, if a stand-up had a really strong point of view, then you can build a show and a universe around that, as, right, opposed to just casting an actor into, yeah, an existing thing and seeing what happens.
Right, but I think they always put it around their personality. You think of Lucy or Danny Thomas, and even in a sense Andy Griffith, who was, he wasn't quite a comic, but he was. He was a storyteller. Andy Griffith used to perform in clubs and had long, you know, he would spin a long yard, so it wasn't joke, but he was a performer. So, you know, Andy Griffith's show was basically, they put it around his personality.
Oh, wow. That actually, I don't think I knew that.
I'm here to educate,
please,
and inform.
So 77, you're hanging out in the clubs, and then when do you decide to start getting up on stage?
Oh, when I was hanging out, I was performing. So in college, I you know, 73 to 77, I would go once or twice in the summer, but I'd wait online on audition night, and, you know, and it got earlier and earlier that they used to give out your number at 5 o'clock, and then it became 3 o'clock, and then 1 o'clock, and then it was like an all day thing. And then you'd come back at night, the show would start at 8, and you'd get on at like 12:30 or 2.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, this is a 15 hour freaking thing now.
For like, what, 3 minutes?
Yeah.
4 minutes?
And so you're camping. Exactly. And it's not good. But I remember this is a very informative moment in my life. Between freshman year and sophomore year, I went and I did it one time. I auditioned one time. And I got back to school. I was on for 5 minutes. I got back to school and they said, hey, what'd you do this summer? And I said, oh, I was a comedian. Like for 5 minutes of the whole summer, but it so felt like something I wanted to define me, and like it was the coolest thing I had done. So yeah, so then, and then in 77 when I graduated, I started just when I say hanging out, I was, you know, at the bar but working, and then,
yeah,
hanging out, because that was part of performing. Like I would say, I used to think, well, if I'm on at 11:40, why don't I just come in 11:39 and I'll leave afterwards? And people go, all the other comics would go, you know, you got to hang out, like. Why?
Yeah.
And they were kind of right, because it was a community, and you'd find out about other gigs, and you would, you know, you would just develop friendships, and your people would help, would throw suggestions like, hey,
yeah,
here's a bit you can put with that bit. And it's like, oh, and it really was a very, and probably, I don't know if it still is because I'm not really in that world, but that the club world. But in my day, and it was a very, in my day, it was a very strong camaraderie, and it was very supportive. I mean, nobody was really backstabbing, because if you were funny, you were going to make it. You didn't. Nobody was going to be in your way. There was no finite number of spots out there.
Well, that's good, because I think, you know, there's some, and maybe this does exist in some places, but I think there is a, I've heard people not in the comedy business think like, oh, it must be pretty cutthroat. Like, yeah, not really. No. I mean, you know, there's a lot. Yeah, I think, you know, Bill Hicks had some sort of an approximation of a quote about the more specific, the something about the, you know, the more you are, the stronger your voice is, the less competition you have.
True.
So you don't, right. it's not like some other comic is going to take a job from you.
Right.
It's like, well, that person was right for that job, and yeah, you could be right for,
yeah,
another,
and that's
job.
A process of finding out. And it takes, you know, at least, I think, 5 years till you sort of find your voice.
God, at least. Yeah,
maybe 10. I think I was doing it 8 years before I started to zero in and feel, A, that I had a little bit of skill, but also starting to find what worked for me and what didn't. Like, you know, I was doing stuff about couples and relationships and like, and that was suddenly scoring so much better. I went, you know, that's what I should write about because that feels natural. And if I'm doing, you know, the difference between LA and New York, you know what? There's 12 guys who will do that better. That ain't me.
Well, yeah, but there's I think kind of a comedy renaissance going on right now. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that there's just so many, you know, there's so many places to do comedy and so many platforms. But I'm kind of curious about, at that time in the 80s, so many people were just working on their 5 to 7 minute sets to, because there's not a lot of like talk show spots anymore. There are not a lot of stand-up comedy shows on anymore. But at that time, you could really do like a great circuit to advertise your comedy. You could do like, you know, Caroline's Comedy Hour, you know, Evening at the Improv. You really could bop around and do a lot of different stuff. So did you focus on your hour? Was your hour like a bunch of 5 to 7 minute chunks, or was your hour like?
That's a good. No, I never was. I was never really good. I never really did a lot of spots on the Tonight Show. I did one spot my very first time where I did stand up, and I had 5-7 minutes maybe that I did, and I cringe if somebody puts, you know, it's out there, and I look like a baby. I mean, I can tell my voice is so high because I was trying to not be nervous, and which only made me sound weird. And I was going so slow because I didn't want to speed up. And you know, I don't think I ever been a guy that's can make a dent in 5 minutes. Like we got to sit back and relax, and you'll have a great time when it's all over. But to squeeze it into 5 minutes was never my thing. But when I did the Tonight Show afterwards, dozens of times, I would do it from the couch.
Right.
So you still have to work on your material, but it was a much different thing. It was, you weren't standing there. I mean, that's why comedy is such a challenging thing. And it's an audacious thing. It's a, you know, to say, I'm going to stand here and I'm going to say things that are funny and you'll laugh. And that's the only reason I'm here. I mean, it's a kind of ballsy thing to say. When you're doing the material from the couch, it's conversation. So the skill is then, well, how do I make this look like I'm actually talking? And I didn't write this within an inch of its life yesterday. Plus, you were doing it with Johnny, who was, you know, a master at setting you up. And you know, he was really great at that. And if I come across old clips, for me, I can see, okay, that's where he stepped in because he thought I needed a new question or needed a little new boost. Or here's where he laid back because I was on a roll. And, you know, I did this show, this There's Johnny, which is on Hulu. And it was – the idea for that was let's go backstage and see what it was like to be there, because that was the golden age. I mean, to me, 72 to 80, 79 maybe, when the Tonight Show moved to L.A., it was in 72. So to me – as a kid in New York, I'm watching, and that just looked like the coolest place to be. Stars are dropping by. So anyway, the show is set backstage, and we use the clips. We actually see little snippets of clips, but we don't ever have anybody play Johnny. And one of the reasons was, or the main reason was, that you can't, everybody knows Johnny so well, or those of us who watched the show back then. And he was so singularly skilled, and everybody now would admit, I mean, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Seth Meyers and Conan certainly will all say, yeah, man, we grew up and we'll do our thing, but it's all based on the shoulders of that. And when part of the fun of this show, of the There's Johnny, was looking through this catalog, you know, we had the full library of clips for our use. And you just watch him. It's like he was just always good, and it was a slower pace. Not every show was
so much slower.
Yeah,
but conversational and not. I mean, like now when you do talk shows, it can be like, you know, you could do the pre-interview, and they're like, oh, do you want to hit anything? And what? Let's try to find these beats. And I feel sometimes like, oh, this feels forced, or I'm trying to force it. But he was so conversational.
Yeah.
But I think that also has to do with the fact that audience attention spans, and there were fewer options.
yeah, it was all of those things are true. There were fewer options, and he was sort of the the consistent, he was the continuum. You know, he was there and you go to bed. It was part of your life, part of your day. You go to bed, you turn on Johnny. You didn't say, oh, I'll tape it and I'll watch it tomorrow. I'll watch it, you know, watch it on the bus. It's like, no, you have to stay up till 11:30. So it became part of your life. And yeah, for sure, the attention span was greater than back then. And so, and then also for many years, his show was 90 minutes. So it was really stretched out.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So about, I think, 73 or 4, it was 90 minutes. So I would watch it and I'd say, well, let me, you know, you put in any name and it'll come up. Let me see Buddy Hackett. And you put, here it is. Here's the 47 times Buddy Hackett was on. And then you pick one and you'd see he's on for 3 segments. Do a commercial, come back, it's still Buddy Hackett. Well, go away and come back, it's still Buddy Hackett. And in my head, I'm going, is it a special? Is it a buddy? What's going on? It's like, no, there's just no rush.
Yeah.
And you'd stay there. You'd stay there for the next guy. So there would be a little spark maybe of the person behind you. You know, the author would be interrupted by Buddy Hackett. It's
right.
Funny. Now you do your thing, gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and at that time too, there were people who were just sort of famous because they were in this ecosystem of doing like Match Game, Hollywood Squares, right. The Tonight Show. Like, and they didn't really work a lot as actors or as much, but you would, you know, they'd perform in Vegas or they'd do the circuit.
They were famous for being on The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And that's something that you don't really have now. I mean, unless you're, you know, if you're on all the time, if you're Andy Richter or something, you get known, okay, that's the guy from Conan. But,
right.
But yeah, there were certainly celebrities whose careers were enforced and created by being on Johnny. And for comics, he was really kind of adventuresome. I mean, he was in some ways very middle of the road. Johnny was so comfortable. That's why he was such a success across the board. He wore well, you know, and he was not radical. But he was the guy who put Steve Martin on. He was the guy who put Albert Brooks on and would fall off his chair laughing at Albert Brooks. And that stuff was so hip. And it was ironic. And he was doing bits about how silly stand-up is or how stupid show business is. And Johnny loved it. So he really fostered so many comics. David Brenner, Stephen Wright, you know, he kind of just said, wow, put him on. And he had him on for the first time and then like a week later, which was unheard of.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I remember that he came on a week later.
It was pretty quick. It might have even been days later. He just clearly loved him and had never seen anything like that. And going back to your point about working on a 5-minute thing, one of the dangers of for some comics back then was you'd work on your 5 and then you'd have nothing behind it. And so if you do well, they'll go, great, come on back tomorrow. Yeah, I got nothing.
Or, hey, we're going to book you on the road. Oh,
So you have to, yeah, it's always good. Like, take your time, and you'll get on. When you're ready, you'll be ready. And the Tonight Show's not going anywhere. But you want to be ready. And I think that was sort of a good advice for any professionals. Like, just get your skills, get your experience, because one of the worst things to do is get an opportunity and then not have the goods to deliver. Like, well, I screwed that up.
It's sort of like the difference between being a great passenger and being a great driver. Like, you really, it's not quite the same thing. And it's impossible to explain to someone, but it really, because you have to build all of the context for the audience.
Yes.
You're in control of
exactly.
Literally everything.
Right.
And you don't sort of get the pass of like, oh, we're just in conversation. Another person's going to contribute. There's going to be a certain energy.
Yeah.
No one has expectations.
And then you're jumping in on their movement.
Yeah, you're tagging out, but there's no, you know, but when you stand alone in front
yes.
of a group of people and
right.
their arms might be crossed and they're like, okay.
Well, yeah, and the word you use is perfect. You have to define the context. It's like, all right, here's what I am. And in the first words, you know, people are going to already form an opinion. This guy is warm and funny, or this guy is odd and really funny, or this guy seems nervous, and whatever it is, it's instant.
Yeah.
And it's a really high wire act.
I was always jealous of the surrealist comics like Emo and Stephen Wright, because they had set this table to where pretty much anything that they said, the audience was already ahead of them a little bit and ready to laugh, because they knew, like, whatever these guys do is going to be weird and surreal. And even if I don't understand every reference, it's
yes.
hilarious.
Right.
As opposed to, and I've never really been able to write that way, as opposed to like when you're just yourself and you're just, you know, then people might go, oh, okay, I get that one. I'm not so into that one.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but that's why I said, for me, it's I so enjoy doing a whole, you know, 80-90 minutes. Yeah, and it's an arc. And over the course of watching any show, you want to have ups and downs. And like, here's here's a stretch where it's really packed with laughs, and then here's a bit where it's a little bit longer story or something. And they're with you, and the context is defined. Like, we're here, you're in the theater, you came, you drove here because you already kind of like me. You bought a ticket, and you don't have to fight uphill. But for those guys, I mean, like, I remember seeing Rodney, who was the master. I mean, that was his stuff was so crisp and so tight, every word. And he would just do joke after joke after joke that were great. But it's like having too many perfect chocolates. It's like after about 30 minutes, you go, I need to change flavors. And so there were guys that you would much rather see do an hour. But the Tonight Show was the perfect format because he'd come out and do 7 minutes of rapid, clearly written stuff. And Johnny was the perfect foil. Johnny loved him. And, and then when he was finished, there was no pretense of like Rodney had a personality beyond the joke. He would just finish the joke, goes, all right, that's it. Johnny goes, so you're done? That's all I have. Whatever.
And also, what a great story for anyone. It's like he didn't really make it until...
No, he failed twice, I believe. He tried it, and I've never seen any tapes or heard anything of who he was in his first incarnation. He went out under his...
Jackie Roy.
And his real name, I think he went out the first time as Jack Cohen, and then Jack Roy. And then, he was in his mid to late 40s when he took on the Rodney persona, the name and the suit, and I don't get no respect. And, suddenly that worked. And he was great. I mean, he knew how to just... polish a joke and also the context was clear. It's like, I get that this is a comedian. This is almost vaudeville. Like this is a clown. This is a guy. And I don't get no respect. I get that. All right. I don't care if it's true or not. This is a guy who's up there and I buy. He's sweating and he's nervous. Like, okay, he probably doesn't get respect.
Yeah, but that sort of caricature, which Steve Martin did too, of like the caricature of a light club act, basically. And it's great because it's sort of freeing to be able to write from the point of view of a character, because that, I think, that's all about, when you're just being yourself on stage, it takes a lot to figure out who am I, what do I like, how do I convey these ideas. But really, I think the fast track to that is just, well, if you can figure out some sort of a caricature, then you sort of know what that dimension, what the dimension and the defining characteristics of that, and then you just write to that, I think can be a little bit of a shortcut as opposed to, this is what I think about life and shit, and I hope you think some of these same things. You know, it's like that character can be very...
Yeah, and everybody has, you have a character. Or even if it's not a character, there's certain things that would be beyond what you could comfortably say on stage. You know, if you're, you don't want to share something that's... The you that you present on stage can't include everything. Right. So, in other words, if you're having a really intimate or a fight with your wife.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, you don't want to be that guy on stage. It's like, hey, that's inappropriate.
That's therapy.
Or you're crying in a movie. Like, all right, that's you, but don't be crying on stage.
Right.
But it's funny about, the context you were saying when we were picking clips for the There's Johnny, streaming now on Hulu. So I used the guys that I wanted to see. So the first episode picked a George Carlin clip, which ended up being perfectly appropriate because it actually helped tell the story and what he was talking about. And so it was a great piece. But we had Rodney in one, we had Albert Brooks in one, and Steve Martin. And the Steve Martin was from, I think December 72. And Johnny introduced him as, here's a very funny, and it was his second appearance. And he said, here's a very funny guy. It's his second appearance. He was here a few weeks ago as a magician. But now he's a comedian. And so some of that is a joke. It's like he's trying something else. But I think at that point, Steve, and he had his hair was still black. And Steve Martin, I think his first time came out and he was doing magic stuff. He was doing twists on it.
I remember that. Yeah, he was doing like, the something balloon trick. Yes. Like, yeah.
So it certainly was a comic, but he was still, it was forming. And then it was very shortly thereafter that he just soared and took off. But you can see the bare bones of it even then on his second appearance. And he was somebody that was always a thrill to watch. And because you knew he always had something new, and he always worked and wrote very meticulously. If he had a 7 minute spot, he would put in 7 minutes of, he wouldn't just sit there. He would never be non-ironic. He wouldn't say, Johnny, you know, if he was doing a bit, he was doing it in quotes.
Right.
Like the bit where he says, you know, I have to go. I'm shooting a movie. You know, he can't stay. And then they go, oh, he's got to go. And then he walks off and he comes
back.
That
is one of my favorite all-time Carson, because it's so weirdly...
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it fucks around with the format.
Yeah, well, so the format, because those of you who don't remember, like, the coolest thing, you do your thing, oh, I got to go, I'm shooting on the Paramount lot.
I'm sorry, I got to go.
And so he walks off, and then he just, a minute later, Johnny's on to the next guest, and Steve Martin comes back and goes, I don't have anything to do.
He peeks out from the crash
day.
I don't have anywhere to go.
And my sense, I'm not sure if Johnny knew that joke was happening, because I remember his laugh seemed so genuine.
He would seem surprised by it.
Yes, so it's possible they kept that from him.
All these people come out and they say they have places to go. Yeah. I just wanted to seem cool.
It was brilliant.
Johnny.
It was brilliant.
Yeah, but having a place where people could go, where he allowed that to happen, where he could go, where you could go and experiment, it's interesting to me because I haven't heard a lot of stories about, like, well, he was really warm. Like, what a great hang after the show. And so for a guy who I think could be so intimidating, it's interesting that he was not super controlling in that way.
No, it's true. I mean, I did the show a lot, and 25 times or something. And he was really very gracious and very welcoming. And there was a period, like 86 to 89 or something, I was on a lot. I mean, like every 7 or 8 weeks for a while. And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. And whatever, it was working. So he and I would do this stuff from the couch. Never hung with him, never saw him a second before the show, which is why on our show, Johnny, I said I wanted him to be just a presence. You know, that was what I felt when I was in the building. If Johnny's going into makeup, everybody clears the halls. Hang on a second. Nobody go out. It's like the president is moving.
Right.
And so you felt his presence every moment, but you didn't hang with him. I'm sure some people did. I think some people went out to dinner with him. But he, in the context of the show, and even during commercials, he would chat with you. That was part of his skill set. He was just gracious, and he made you feel comfortable. And I remember I did a bit. It was sort of a concept bit. Like, it's actually of that school, of the Steve Martin bit, of doing a, you know, I want to be cool like those guys. So I came on. I was doing some movie, And, you know, it was, well, you do a movie and you show a clip and you want to set this clip up. And I joked, my joke was, we couldn't get the clip, but I have some cards here that with pictures and stick figures and I can walk you through it. And so I had a friend who's an artist and drew 10, you know, big, you know, what are they called? Those poster boards things. And I would flip it. And the joke was, it wasn't really clear. I think about it now. Like, the joke was, A, that I don't have a clip and I'm using cards. But on top of that, I was trying to make the story funny. Anyway, so about 3 cards in, it was clear that this is just really dumb. And I remember Johnny looking at me on the air and just going, I think he even said, like, you started it. Let's go.
You're going to finish every one of these cigars?
Yes. But it was sort of like, you know, he used to get his greatest laughs about bombing. You know, a joke would miss. And that would be, so here was... All right, this is not really working well, but he made it fun. And instead of me being embarrassed, it's like, wow, I really felt embraced. Like, yeah, I'm going to treat you like like a peer. Like, go ahead,
man. That's so funny, because those talk show audiences can be so mainstream that I think they're never really prepared for any level of irony. So if you say to them, like, why, you know, I wasn't able to get a clip, that I think they think, oh, he really wasn't able to get a clip. And wow, I can't believe he had to show these pics. Like, they would take it literally.
No, but talk about your context. I was trying to do something fun and different. And it didn't quite fit my personality. I didn't know how to sell it. Where Steve Martin would have sold it better, and
but
it would
you
have
tried something
yeah.
though.
Well, that was I was proud of that, and I'm proud of it now. That, like, oh, I tried something to do a little different.
But you also, at the same time that you were doing stand-up, you're actually doing a lot of big movies, which was not entirely common for, like, I feel like, with the exception of, you know, Eddie Murphy, a handful of people. Not all stand-ups did a lot of movies in that time. Like, there were, you know, people were stand-ups, and then there were you know, movie people. But, you know, Diner, Beverly Hills Cop, Aliens. I mean, these are really big movies.
They ended up really dovetailing and making, for me, it sort of made it happen. Like, I had, before 82, yeah. Excuse me. I think I had auditioned to be on The Tonight Show a number of times, and, you know, it wasn't ready, and, like, we'll call you, you're not ready. And then in 82, Diner came out, April of 82, and I got on. And I got on because I had that sort of wind at my back, it's like, here's a new movie, and he's a funny kid, and he's in this movie, and there's a little buzz about this movie, here's this kid. So I had that, and I was like, that got me in the door. Without Diner at that moment, I mean, I'm sure I would have gotten on just solely on my strength as a comic, ultimately, but this really opened that door. And, you know, and Aliens 2 was certainly... it was a big deal movie that I was able to go on and talk about stuff. It's interesting, you know. those things are fun and they're great things to be a part of, but in my head, they sort of help sell other things. Like, you know, this year, like, I had three things that came out just coincidentally, all within like a few weeks of each other. And I was, Red Oaks came out, the last season of Red Oaks was on Amazon, and Stranger Things, which was the big thing on Netflix. And then my, you know, labor of love was this There's Johnny, which is on Hulu. So I knew Stranger Things was, well, let's come on and talk about Stranger Things. And I would get on the show because of Stranger Things. I go, great, let's talk about There's Johnny, because I wasn't going to get on with just that. So, you know, that's what they, it's interesting. Sometimes you get on a show because you want to plug that thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I'll get on with one thing because I actually want to talk about something else. Or, you know, in the case of like an Aliens or Beverly Hills Cop, at that time it's like, well, this will be good because, not because I need you to see the movie. You're going to go see it anyway. But, oh, that's the guy from that movie. We'll go see him in the theater. We'll go see him in the club. So it was used, you know, to help, you know, help sell tickets.
Beverly Hills Cop was an interesting, I mean, that style of... you know, like big budget action comedy, you know, that was a really incredible time for, I guess maybe Will Smith is someone who still does you know, like big budget action comedies. I don't feel like I see a lot of them anymore, but that movie, you know.
It was because of Eddie Murphy's huge talent. I don't know that genre would have busted open. You know, Martin Lawrence did, and Mark Wahlberg, some of the comedies are Mark Wahlberg, Will Ferrell, and Melissa McCarthy, and the you know, Spy, and those sort of the new R comedies, which are, I mean, R-rated comedies. But it was a moment, but I think it was totally, Eddie just blew that door open because on sheer magnetism and talent.
And so, spinning off of all of that stuff, then when did My Two Dads start?
That was 87, 8, and 9, I think. And that was after Aliens. And I got this pilot, and I was thinking, I don't know if I want to do this. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, most pilots don't go anyway. So I said, I'll do it. I'll get the chair. Whatever. You know, I wasn't, you know, in the money. I go, make a nice little check, and that'll be fine. And did the show. It was fine. And I remember like 6 weeks later getting a call from my manager. Hey, the show got picked up. I said, what show? Remember the thing with it? I said, Are you kidding? Really? That got picked up? Oh, my. So suddenly I was on that. And, you know, and it was a very educational experience for me because it was never a show that I personally, it didn't reflect my tastes.
Right.
It wasn't me, and it was very hard for me to do my comedy in it and to feel like myself. But two things I learned. One is that you don't have to use the product in your own home to enjoy the product, right?
Right.
So the fact that there were lots of people who were enjoying it is a good thing. It didn't matter that I didn't particularly, or my friends didn't watch it. But it also helped me learn how to do the format of what a half-hour comedy is, what a script looks like, what a 23 minutes of show looks like. And it also, because it wasn't quite to my taste, it helped me realize, okay, the next time I do this, if I do this again, I really want it to be my taste. So when that was off, it was like 3 years. I don't even know if it was a full three, but somewhere by the end of 3 years, it was off. And I wasn't really particularly looking to do something. And a studio came to me and they said, you know, would you want to develop something for yourself? And I go, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I want to do half. I said, well, if I did, because I didn't feel like I had loved that experience. I said, if I did, it would really be really small, and it would be like something like that. Instead of people coming over, my two dads, it was people coming over, go, you know, my daughter loves your show.
Right.
That's sweet. I wanted to show with people my age and going, oh man, I watched that. My wife, we watched that. We relate to that. So I wanted something that was really reflected me, not because what I said was so important, but because, like, then I didn't have to work too hard.
Well,
right,
and, also,
and I made it as much like me. So, like, yeah, let me just talk like me and write the story like me, because then I know it will come from a real place.
Yeah, and also, listen, it's great to get a job, but, you know, once you have a job for a couple of years, it's kind of nice to... you know, not disclaim your job, like, oh, I work on this thing, but yeah, you probably, I don't know, if you have kids, you know, like, to go, yeah, you know, I made this thing and I'm really proud of it. You know, the thing about my two dads is that I feel like even as a teenager, I was like, who has a car-shaped couch in their living room?
Yep.
How is that a thing that someone has?
A table made out of a bicycle. And I remember used to say, because I used to hurt myself. I walk by the table and go, you know, and a pedal just hit me in the crotch. And I go, I get it, he's an artist, but can we now get a regular table? Like, never mind the comedy reality. I just keep hurting myself.
It just had to, you know, yeah, but it's in character. It's in character. You had to do it in character. But Mad About You definitely was much more of a, you know, a grounded, but still kind of, you know, hyper reality.
Well, it's hyper in that nobody's life is funny 23 minutes in a row.
Right.
And then quiet for a week. And then funny 23 minutes later the following week. So obviously it's created and it's compressed. But we always strived. What's the past tense of strive?
Let's say stroven, throw off the grammar people.
We endeavored to make it real.
Endeavoring
to keep it real. And we used to say, oh, it's about the little things. And in a sense, I mean, in a very true sense, it was about the little things. It's the moments. It's the look between a husband and a wife. It's the little space between two people who are not communicating that can grow into something. It was all these little subtle nuances. And then we would periodically have a show that was just so over the top, you know, virtual reality where Christie Brinkley is giving me a massage. And we would go, yeah, it's the little things like that. But that was our first season. And that was a very pivotal kind of show, that episode, because we took a really high concept, virtual reality, and that – right, so it was very over the top. It wasn't real, but what was real was the story was that I made an investment without checking with my wife, and so the best, even though we had this crazy thing with virtual reality, here's Christie Brinkley in a negligee. The heart of the show was the subsequent scene where we're getting ready for bed, and husband and wife, and Helen Hunt and I sit there, and I try and explain to her. It's not a waste of money. You're going to see, because you can do anything. And she starts to warm to the idea. I said, you can go skiing. You can, you know, you could, all these wonderful things. She says, I guess. What did you do? I go, me, I got a massage from Christie Brinkley. So it became the fight and the tension between the wife and the husband was the story. And the other stuff is just catalyst. So I always use that as an example of, we always came back to keeping it real. And that was something that, had I not had the experience of the first show, I might not have been so allergic to non-real stuff.
When was that? 93? 90? When was
Mad About You? Yeah. 92. September 92.
And doing a virtual reality episode. Very forward thinking.
Right?
I got to say. Very forward thinking.
Wish I had actually invested.
All that time ago.
Yeah.
Because I worked on I was doing a sitcom at Culver Studios in like 98, and I think we were in the stage next to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the show?
It was a show called Guys Like Us. We were on for a season.
I remember that.
On UPN, which is not a network anymore. It was, and that was one of those like, oh my God, I'm on a sitcom. I bought a fancy car.
Yeah.
And then we didn't get picked up for the back nine. That was pretty much that.
When I moved to California, I got in 83, and pretty soon thereafter, I got a pilot and I got a part in a movie. It was a lead in a movie. I said, well, I'm going out and buying a car. And about 2 days into the shooting, the producer and the director come to my house and go, listen, the studio's not happy.
oh, no.
You're out. And I go, and I remember thinking, oh, no. I just bought a car. And I go, oh, no, you'll get paid. I go, all right, then that's
fine. All right, fine.
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
Well, you know, it can really fuck with your head, because especially if you're young and all of a sudden you get – it's like you're not used to seeing – you don't really know how the finances of the entertainment business work. So you hear this number, which is a gross number.
Yes.
Oh, my God, you're going to make, you know, $25,000 a week. Oh, my God, that's crazy that anyone would get paid that much. And you still end up with a decent amount of money, but it's like, oh, okay, well, there's like 25% goes to agent, manager, lawyer. Then yes. another 50% goes to taxes. And then you right. can't work on anything else, and it's only for a short period of time, and right. then you realize.
And there's another factor that I think is prevalent among actors. Every job that you get, you spend the money three times. The minute you land the job, you go, woohoo, I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy some crazy shit. The minute you haven't got, then you do the job and you say, well, I'll celebrate, and you go buy some more crazy shit. And then later the check comes and you actually go out and buy some. So you've spent that money three times now.
Four if you get a syndication check.
There you go.
Like, oh, I get some reruns.
And when it's all done, you go, I now have a car and a nice stereo and $7.
What happened?
What happened? What did I do wrong here?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, the money part of it's kind of a mind fuck too, I would imagine, especially, I mean, were you comfortable as a performer when fees and finances start becoming news stories? You're like, oh, this person's getting this much and now this actor's getting this much. Are you like, hey, is it okay if we don't talk about that stuff?
Yeah, I always found that kind of grotesque. And I never wanted to know anybody. I remember growing up, it was sort of, for good or for bad, it was sort of a nebulous secret. I just never had any idea what my dad made.
Right.
And like, you know, it was his, I don't know that it was so healthy, but I kind of do that with my kids. Like, they would go, well, Dad, what is a house like this cost? I go, well, don't worry about it. And when my younger son, when he was like five or six or something, he came, seven, he came home from school, and he said, Dad, what do you do? Because this was after that. I was home, and I was so happy to be home, and I loved just being in the house. And I was writing, but I was like, oh, this is wonderful for them. I'm here when he comes home from school. And then he's going, you're here a lot, Dad. You seem to be. And then and I remember one time he said, but how can we afford this? And I go, well, okay. I had a nice run, and it was a very big success, and we were very lucky, and Mom works hard, and Mom's making good. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about the numbers. And now I know I'm sort of launching him into the world with, you know, this Beverly Hills show business distortion. I just go, so a shirt is $1,100? Is that normal?
Yeah. Yeah, especially in this town.
Well, he's actually cool because he's actually so much more fiscally responsible, and he's somehow, and it's not from me, but or even his mom. I think he's just sort of on his own decided, well, I don't want to buy it. That's too expensive. I'm not going to spend that. It's like, oh, good for you, man. How'd you figure that out? And he did. And, you know, I think you get stuff from your parents, but you also figure out what you need to.
Well, what's a good bit of advice? You know, because I think, you know, I feel like people spend so much time talking about like how to make it. But I feel like not enough people talk about how to be successful, how to succeed, because it really can screw with your head if you're not used to it. It can be very self-destructive. And so, you know, that last season of Mad About You, where everyone's making shit tons of money, obviously you had done well up to that point, but that was insane. And so are you not thinking about it or planning or just trying to not get in your head about it? Or are you able to separate it?
No, I mean, it's embarrassing, you know, to be able to talk about, because it's an obscene, you know, when a show does well, you get stupid amounts of money. It's what you hope. I mean, right. You want to do well. And it's not because they're giving it out. They're giving it out because it has value. Your skills and what you've created is bringing in dollars. People are coming to see it, so therefore it's worth it. They're not, you know, not doing it as a charity case.
Yeah,
so
by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to stick on that point just because it's the only time, like when actor salaries get into the news and people go, man, I can't believe they're paying that fucking guy. It's like that's the only time where people side with corporations, I think, right. Without realizing, as you go, yeah, the studio's not going to give that money to an orphanage. Like, it's just a profit share of the show that they are making.
We're going to give him 20 million.
100 times that.
Yes, because we'll make 100 times that. So yeah. It's worth it. But I mean, we were always aware that, wow, we're in a really kind of golden moment and this is great and it ain't always going to be like this. I mean, we're very aware of that. In all corners, and in that we're not going to always be this busy. We're not going to always have a show that's going to be, you know, top rated. We're not going to, you know, most likely not be making this kind of dough. So, I mean, we were all pretty responsible and didn't get crazy. But, I mean, the interesting thing about, you say, nobody knows how to prepare for success. It's a different world even now because there's so much, you know, the internet and the speed and everything is everything. So you say anything and it's around the world in a second. That didn't even 25 years ago when I was on TV, you could do an interview and it would, if you said something stupid, it would come back to haunt you, but it wasn't every day or
right.
every misfire, everything. So it was easier to have a bit of restraint and privacy, but I think it's also, everybody's different. You know, I know people who are don't have money and are really messed up. And I know guys, you know, people who make a lot of money and they're really grounded. It's like, yeah, because they're... I love when people say, you know, you're married 30 years. That's so amazing for a show business. I went, it's not show business. It's like, you know, there are people get divorced who are plumbers and teachers. And,
right.
And, right. So it has nothing to do with that. But it's just sort of the outside projection of what people think show business might be.
Yeah. But I do think that unlike most businesses, though, show business puts people in situations. There are situational. It's like, you know, a plumber doesn't have to go to work and part of their job is making out with someone, you know, whereas, yeah, you know, to clean out those pipes, you know, like it's not that. I mean, I feel like this business in particular, people are gone for long periods of time. Yeah. And so I feel like there's a lot of rocky road that I think people have to put extra time in their relationship to make sure that they don't drift away from each other, because I feel like, you know, this business does foster a certain bit of narcissism to make it function. You know, you have to spend a lot of time with yourself, thinking about yourself, your career, I think, to move it forward, especially if you're a comic or you're an actor. And so I think that can sort of create the walls if you're not paying attention. Like, sometimes it's about other people too.
Yeah, and in my case, it was almost a double-edged sword, because I was mining my marriage and my relationship for material.
Right.
Right? Unabashedly. But as were all the other writers, and we'd all come in with stuff. And so you'd get applauded and rewarded for, what a caring husband. Look how Paul and Jamie. I go, yeah, but to get that moment, I had to stay late at work 4 days in a row, right, and I didn't get to talk to my wife.
You're seeing all the cracks.
Yeah, you're seeing the false reproduction. But like then you come home and go, and I'd say something and my wife would be upset. And I go, you know, I don't think that's what the wife says here. The wife says, we wrote it totally different.
Or she's like, don't you dare write that down.
Yeah, well, that would always, yeah. Well, but I was much more at a quicker filter than even she did. I wouldn't ever want to put anything that was too real or that would clearly look like it was me and her. But I still do that. Even like I do stuff about, you know, us, and I go, can I share that? She goes, go ahead. But there's a bit that I do that was an argument that we had that was so funny to me. It was in a car, and my son was in the back, and it was just a silly thing that snowballed into a big, and it was just like, oh my God, even while it was happening, I'm going, this is great. This is unbelievable. Part of what I loved about being on Mad About You is that when you have those marriage moments, they're leavened and enlightened by going, oh, this is going to be a great scene. And it gives you, a little bit of a distance to remove that you can see, like, oh yeah, this is all fun. Not that I shouldn't take it seriously, and I don't want, you know, it's not funny that you're upset or that I'm upset, but right, just stand back and it's all silliness.
Yeah, it also makes you not take that stuff as seriously,
right? Right.
As opposed to oh, this means everything. Like, oh, this is actually really good,
right? But it was always a little harsh, you know, awakening to have this set where, oh, you know, and Paul says this and Jamie says that, and well, what a terrific couple. And come home and go, okay, she's not on script at all. My wife is really cutting into me here.
And you also got to be careful because you don't. Because it's something that might be super funny between the two of you because you have sort of an inside thing with each other, and an audience is like, oh my God, what?
Well, but that's, you know, that's part of the filter that you get as a stand-up. I remember so many guys, you know, try something. Something happens to you or comes to you in your mind, and you try it out that night. And for a big swatch of us who were observation comics, you go, hey, you ever noticed blah, blah, blah. And the good bits, people will laugh because, yeah, man, I did notice that. Right, that's so true. Once in a while, you come up with something, you go, you ever notice this? And everyone looks at you like, no, man, that's just you. That's just you. I remember somebody did, it was a really grotesque bit about something about taking a dump and just looking at it and the structure. He saw an image. I went, yeah, you know what? Don't do that.
Everybody
had that experience, they're not going to laugh because they don't want to be that person. So you're going to hang right up there. That's just you.
Well, that's a tough one. Those are tough bits to sell in like 5 and 10 minute sets.
Yes.
You can sandwich that in if people, as long as, again.
I wish you didn't use the word sandwich there, but. Yes.
You can sandwich the shit bits.
Yes, you can get away with things again, because when the context is, oh, I get it, and he's, here's the parameters, and he's not going to be mean. He's not going to be racist or right. misogynistic. Okay. So now we know that. So if something pushes the edge a little bit, I feel okay. Whereas if you just came out and you said, let me tell you something about broads, I go, check, please.
Come on, we're out. Yeah, well, it can really be, you know, the audience as a whole is sort of like a big horse, you know? You know what I mean? Like, they have to trust.
You lead them to the comedy water?
Kind of, yeah. Like, if it, you know, I think people come to a comedy show wanting and expecting to be led. And if they don't feel like the person on stage can lead them, either because they don't identify with them or because that person doesn't have the skill set to do it,
yes,
then they won't follow, right. You know? I think they want to be led. That's why they come,
right.
They come in for the
and
ride.
And they
want to
relax and know that you're in charge.
Yeah.
But I remember reading something. Billy Connolly was talking, or maybe it was in a documentary. One of the comedy documentaries I saw recently, and Billy Connolly was talking about, he goes, it's like you're a shepherd or a cat wrangling cats, right? And you're just roping, you're getting them all together. And then if somebody interrupts and somebody heckles or distracts or something, then they scatter and you got to go fucking wrangle everybody back. And then only when they're together can you lead them where you want to go. But first you got to get them together.
Yes.
Right? And part of that is literally, like I'm just talking about horse being drawn to water, the audience has to be defined as an audience. They come in and they're 1,000 different people, whatever, 2,000 different people, and they don't know how to be an audience. They don't know each other. And that's why I love to have an opening act, somebody go out there and just let them practice paying attention. Let them practice, okay, let me get into my seat. Let me forget about the phone call I have to make. All right, now I know how to be an audience. We're an audience. But it doesn't happen right away.
Right.
And if you come out, if you're the first guy, you go, ooh, they're still settling in.
Come out cold. They're just putting their purses down.
They need to go through their own process. And let somebody has to help them become an audience.
Yeah, and it's figuring out how to shorten that time between the time you walk on stage to getting them to be that audience. But, you know, obviously, like you said, it's helpful when people come to see you on purpose.
Yes.
Then it's not like they just wandered in off the street. Like, you better be funny. And then that can be a whole different skill set.
We used to talk about, in the very beginning, we used to have, what were they called? These shows that were called Nooners in the afternoon. And some, you know, entrepreneurial comic would say, you know, I got a show. We're going to do it at City College at 1 o'clock.
Ugh.
And you go, really? I go, oh, it's in the cafeteria in London. You go, okay. And here's, everybody's going to get $20. All right. And you'd go, and not only didn't they come to see a show, did they not come to see a show, they're eating. They have something they want to do. So now you're interrupting them.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to go, put down your sandwich, and here's some shit that I thought of that maybe will make you laugh. And they're looking at you like, what the hell, man? We're trying to talk.
That's more interference.
Yeah.
But if you can thrive in that environment.
Yeah, if you do well, God bless
you're bulletproof.
If you can turn them around.
If you can get them to turn around from their lunch trays. Well, I think most people don't really understand how that comedy needs a little bit of like setup. They're like, oh, we'll just put the comic over here. It's comedy. Like, you know, people kind of need to be at least facing the right way
and not
looking down at their food trays.
Yeah. There's a lot of subtle little things.
So Mad About You is coming back, yes?
No.
I thought it was.
It was a very premature rumor that, but it said we were talking about it, which we are. We were talking about it. And for years we had always said, and I was really clear that I didn't ever want to come back because we did it 7 years and we ended it really well and we did everything we wanted to do and it's like sailed off into the sunset perfectly. And so I didn't ever want to come back and ruin the moment. And then it was, you know, I'm never the first guy in a pool. It's like somebody has to jump. So when I saw a couple of people are doing it and I was having lunch with Helen Hunt, I said, well, what do you think? Would you ever want to? She goes, well, I don't know. It could be fun. And so then we just really were just talking about it. Like, is there something we could do? Is there a way to make it worthwhile that you certainly can't come back and be that same people, right? Because especially our show, which is about reality, so they're not newlyweds, and so their life has to be different 25 years later. Our little baby would have been out of the house already, so it's a different point in our life. So if we can come back and write a story about the same people now in their 50s and 60s with the same precision and same sort of warm insight and sort of courageous little excavations of craziness, then it'll be great. But you know, you certainly don't want to go back and go, no, we're newlyweds and I just look a little heavier.
Can I just pitch to you why I think it would work?
Go ahead.
Because because it was so based in their relationship,
yeah,
I think it would be interesting to see where they ended up all these years later, because obviously circumstances are going to change, their environment's going to change, they're going to have matured as people, but at the core, they're still the same people. So seeing seeing the next chapter in their lives and being able – it's just sort of like checking in on friends you haven't seen for a long time because of the nature of the type of show it was.
Yeah.
You don't have to try to go back to what you guys were before. You can just take the honest bits from the relationship now. I think it would really work.
I think it could. As I said, we might do it. We're just we're kicking it around and somebody went to press a little too early and said, they're talking about coming back. And it's been really actually very flattering how many people stop me on the street and go, oh, I heard you coming back. That's great. It's like, okay, we're not sure we are. But, one of the things, it was always an investigation of a relationship. And one of the things, the sort of existential questions of a relationship is like, why are we in this, right? So in the beginning, you're drawn to each other chemically, sexually, magnetically, and then you get to know each other and it builds and you grows and you have kids. And when the kids are grown, then you're landing in a different place. And we actually, in the finale of Mad About You, at the end of our seventh year, we did a little thing where we jumped into the future. We showed a little bit 5 years ahead, 20 years ahead. So we saw, and in fact, they broke up, they came back together. And so that's why I always thought there's no need to come back. But one of the things that would be interesting if we did do it is to say, well, all right, absent our youth and absent raising a child, let's say we have a couple of 20, 30 years later left in us.
Yeah.
Is it important that we spend it together, or we gave it a great shot, it was good. Why don't you go free and I'll go free? It's like, what is it that will keep you together? And, at 60, it's very different than at 25. Your needs are different. Your life is different. So in a way, it could be interesting because it's sort of new in the same way that marriage was new to them at 25 years ago, this moment in life. And I'm sort of going through it, which gives me a little bit of understanding of what the show could be, because my youngest son is about to go off to college and I'm dreading it. I think I'll have a great time and I love to travel with my wife and all that. But it's like, so that whole chunk of raising kids, having a baby, and now it's over.
That's it.
And here we are. Oh my God. Remember the old people? With them. With them. Wow.
I don't know, man. I think there's something really interesting in there, because I think...
You write it.
I think what could be new about it is the idea that, maybe the show picks up where they've just kind of rediscovered each other. They had been broken up for a while. And so the newness factor is them coming back together and sort of reuniting and sort of saying like, okay, we were together when we were young. It didn't work out after a while. We kind of went off. We were with other people. We had other adventures. And then when we got older, our priorities shifted and we kind of discovered like, actually, we do kind of like each other. But how do we like, because
how to get your way back?
How do you get your way back? So many of these things seem familiar. Oh, now you've changed. But just kind of watching them navigate, especially because you get really rigid when you start to get older, you get set in your ways. And so I just think there's a lot of authentic comedy to be had there.
It's funny. One of the things in just toying with discussing it, and Helen and I were talking, that one of the things that makes her such a great actress is she's really real, and she never just stands there and does a line. She's always moving. Like we used to joke in the first season, we never saw her face because she was blurring, moving, cleaning, getting. And one of the things, certainly in the beginning of our show, was that momentum. It's like, we just got to get out the door. Can we please get out the door? And that's when life happens. Like, oh, I can't believe we just closed the window. We leave it alone. We'll get it later. Wait, you forgot your phone. Oh, my God. So there's this momentum, right, that was part of the show and the DNA. Well, at 60, I don't think we're going to have that same speed. So like, well, if we did a show, how slowly would they be getting out of the house? And now when you forget your phone, it's like, oh, I forgot I even have a phone. It's not that you misplaced it. Do I have a phone? you're forgetting bigger things.
I mean, I really do think, especially for people who watched the show then, I vote for, and okay. I'm not someone that thinks that everything needs to be revisited or rebooted or whatever, but I really do think because of the nature of what the show was, that it was just sort of a very kind of honest, authentic portrayal of a relationship, you have new relationship stories to tell, and these characters definitely could have rediscovered each other all these years later.
Why don't you talk me into it?
Okay, good. I'm glad.
All right.
That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
If you're ever on the fence about it, just shoot me a text.
No.
What do you think? Do it, Paul.
You make a good point, and it could absolutely be fun. And if we do it, and I hope there's enough people who show up and want to watch it. I think there are. One of the things that was a nice little bonus for me when I started going out and doing stand-up again a few years back, I hadn't done it for 20 years. So all the Mad About You years, I never went out. And so now when I go out, A, the people coming to the show, but afterwards I'll do a little meet and greet, and people invariably have a story about an episode that was important to them, or a joke that, our wife and I still make that joke that you did in episode 27. And, or, we got married to the theme song for your show, or like, I never really got this feedback back then, this direct face-to-face of people going, that show really was important to us, not as in the social commentary, but just like we cared for that show. We related and it helped us. And it's like, wow, I never really processed that or heard it. So that's been a nice thing for me for getting out of the house.
Why did you not do stand up during that show? Because I would think that'd be a prime.
Wow. Believe me,
was all
I
your
kick myself now.
Just going into the making of the show, and you just didn't feel like you had any extra.
I didn't want to do at the time. I didn't want to just do my old act as it was, and I felt sort of consumed by the show. I mean, like, for you're making it like August to March, you're making the show, and then you take a little breath in April, and then May you start writing next year.
You just don't feel like going out on the road and slogging it out.
I didn't have the energy or the focus, and some guys did. I think Ray went out and Jerry went out, and I never felt like I could. So. But I kicked myself because now when I was ready, I go, yeah, so where were those $1 billion a night gigs? Oh, no, Paul. Oh, those are gone.
Oh, yeah, you needed to be on television for those.
Why didn't you tell me that?
But those money gigs are corporate gigs, and you don't want to do those. Those can be rough. The corporate gigs can be really rough.
Even if they're good, there's something not good about them.
Well, because you're talking about, a comedy club, everyone is coming to a location that's not their home turf. When you get a community of people together that all work in the same office together, you're coming into their house. By force they came to see you because there was probably mandated by their boss, and now they have to fucking pay attention to some lunatic on stage talking about something or other.
That's why the checks have to be big.
That's right. Take the big check and wipe the sweat off your forehead.
Yeah, to go through that, there has to be some reward. So if it's going to be not rewarding and not fun, and it's going to be work, then the check has to be big.
That's the sliding
scale.
Whereas
on the other hand, when I go to work on some material, and I'll go down to the Comedy and Magic Club here. And I remember when I started showing up, and like younger comics going, wow, what are you doing here? Like, nothing. You have a special? No. You're going out.
Like comedy.
I'm just doing it. And I remember when my son, at the time, this is like 5-6 years ago, he'd never seen me go out of the house at night. Like, where are you going? I'm going to do a show. Are they paying you? I went, no. He goes, why would you do it? And I went, because I'm getting something. I need the stage time. I need I need it. I need that. And so they're giving me the opportunity. Whereas the other end of the spectrum is, I don't need to talk to 1,000 accountants in a room.
Right.
So the check has to be
to make
me fly to Detroit.
To take the edge off what the experience was.
Yeah.
What's the slew of everything that you want to promote? Let's get everything out here.
All right. So here is the main thing is this. There's Johnny.
There's Johnny on Hulu.
Which is on Hulu. See, it was originally on CISO, which has since folded.
Not a thing anymore.
Right. So we were the first show to ever cancel a network. They made them collapse the tent. And so we were an orphan. And then we were sort of adopted by Hulu. And we're sort of in this nebulous thing. We're not quite a Hulu original, and we're not quite, we bought 30 Rock. This is new, but it's ours. But I don't know that they're necessarily want to go make a second season. So I'm telling everybody, go. I'm really, really proud of the show, and it was such. There's such great actors on the show: Jane Levy and Ian Nelson, and Tony Danza plays Freddy DeCordova, and it came out really, really great. So I do want everybody to see it just because I'm proud of it. I'm not in it. But I created it with my buddy David Simon, and who knows if enough people chime in and write it, Hulu may go, all right, well, now we see that everybody likes it, because I would love to go make some more. And that's it. Then I have a couple of, that's the only thing to promote. And then I got a couple of pilots that I've written that I'm also not in, but I'm hoping to get work on those this year. And
stand-up dates?
Yeah, I'm going to Cleveland March 24th, I think. I'll be at the Hard Rock Casino. When does this will be airing in an hour?
This is going up, Katie. Yeah.
Right now. Whenever you're listening, it's right now.
It aired a week ago.
All right, but that's in March. That's where I know. And yeah, I keep meaning to, like, really go out and do like a month of gigs. And I always go, yeah, I just do two and I'll come home.
Well, yeah, but that's a great thing though, is you could do like, you know, even if you do two weekends a month.
Yes, that's kind of my goal.
You can go every other weekend and yes. Then it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm on the road. You know, you just
no,
come
it doesn't
and
feel
do
like,
it.
Exactly.
And you're just doing one-nighters, so you're not doing like.
Right. So yeah, this past weekend I did two shows in two towns in Colorado. And it's so funny, I've learned that the further you go, the happier they are to see you. So I was in this little town, a ski town, way up in the mountains, this beautiful little town of Silverthorne. And everyone's going, why are you here? How did you pick us?
Why us?
I said, because it's one flight away.
Yep.
And you had a theater and you had people who bought tickets. I'll show up.
And you came out.
And they were great. And so, yeah, to me, it's really fun. And it's the more you do it. I mean, I know when I do two, three shows in a row, then you get to explore and you get to really polish it. And then you take a week or two off and it falls back.
It's, yep.
So you have to keep it sharp. So I really do want to someday just clear the calendar and say, let's do five shows a week for 2 or 3 months, which I haven't ever done. And I think that would be really fun and rewarding for you, the American people.
You should. I've been doing clubs because I'm trying to get a new hour together, and it's time consuming, but it's great because you just do like five shows in a couple days. And then you just, you know, it's yeah. Like you just, you get.
But did you start with zero? You start with scratch, from scratch?
Well, when was my special aired? 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago. And then, yeah, I just had to start over. And I started going out with a little bit of material and a lot of crowd work. And then just slowly over time.
I always have that in my mind. It's like, okay, I want to start literally clean, which I guess I did 5 or 6 years ago when I started going back. I didn't do anything. Oh, but now it's like, okay, I have 2 hours, whatever, of material. I'd like to put it aside and just start a new hour. But I never can really do it because when you go up, you want to just at least do one or two
at
bits.
At the theater,
that you know.
It's hard because that's so presentational. You can do it in a club because you're in the yes. crowd. You can fuck around a lot. But in a theater, people expect to see
yeah.
a very
but
presentational
it's,
show.
But it's literally like collecting like little beads, and then you got to put the beads all together. Okay, now it's a big full thing. But that's the fun of it. I mean, this weekend, you know, I had one bit that was sort of new, and I was working on it, and it made me so happy. And it was sort of the same feeling I remember when I was 18 and went on stage for the first time. It's like, oh, that joke worked. I can't wait to go back tomorrow. Oh, if I just trim that and move that there, that's going to be perfect. And of course, you never get it perfect, which is why we keep doing it.
I'll tell you what. Here's my pitch to you.
Go ahead.
All right. So Mad About You comes back. You take it to Netflix, and then you package it with a Paul Reiser stand-up special.
Now you're thinking, Chris. I like
and,
the way you're thinking.
And then it all sort of drops around the same time. The special drops a couple months leading up to Mad About You, so people get that Paul Reiser flavor back in their minds, yeah. And then you fucking drop Mad About You a couple months later.
I like how you're thinking. Done.
Done.
I don't know how you – not my manager. How's That would be cool. Yeah, actually, it'd be interesting to go to a Netflix. And one of the thoughts is if we put it on streaming, it changes. No commercials, right? So
yep.
it changes the structure.
Yep.
And the content changes, so you can actually say cocksucker.
Yeah.
which we were not allowed to for so many years.
No, it turns out you still can't say that on network television.
We said we'll trade seven hells for one asshole. Can we just say asshole once?
And they were like, no.
Sometimes that's the only word that'll work.
Yeah, so you can swear and then you can really up the sexual content.
Yeah, but we're older.
Netflix.
that ship might have sailed. yeah, you can, right.
Well, I'm just glad that you came on and that I mean, you know, I've been watching you for years and, you know, and you always seem like such a nice guy and you are a genuinely nice guy. And that makes me very happy. And I love to hear what a comedy fan you are.
Thank you. Yeah, listen, you know, those of us who do it, it's not because we have a choice.
Right.
It's so funny. My son was with me when I bumped into a comedian friend and afterwards he said, I never see you get animated like that with anybody else. I go, yeah, comics like talking to other comics.
They just, there's a certain, and you can identify, you can spot, when you meet people, you can go, oh, they're a comedy person. You can kind of tell. Everyone's got a little extra, and they activate each other,
yes.
You know, like comics activate each other. Right.
Well, I thank you for having me on. This
Thanks,
is
Paul Reiser. It's good to see you.
By the way, there's no cameras at all. I don't know if that's holding you back. Do you notice that people don't see anything?
No, they're not. They're seeing with their ears.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're seeing with their ears.
I just was afraid. If you were hoping that this was going to be seen.
Well, there's all hidden cameras everywhere. So, right. You know, we're live streaming 24/7. Ugh, God,
we're here from your home. Do people know that we're in your home?
We're in my house right now. Yeah, because we used to do these. I did the show for Comedy Central, and we used to record there because I was working there all the time, and then that show ended, and we've just been doing them at my house, which is wonderfully convenient for me. I hope it wasn't too inconvenient for you.
No, it was fine, but I'm looking all over the fireplace there. You have some antique guns.
Some antique guns, yeah. There's a blunderbuss up there. There's a big, long rifle, some small hand... I mean,
operative?
These are all, no. These are... No.
If a burglar from the 1700s came in,
yes,
you could take him down with that.
Then I would take him down, and he would, because he was a burglar from the 1700s, he would know to be polite to wait so I could pack the gunpowder in the end and then put the little ball in.
Hang on.
I shall give you your load times. but these are all like 19th century antique guns. My wife and I both always wanted to live in a museum, so our house very much sort of Adams Family style.
It is. It's very cool.
Everything is antique and sort of museum-esque.
Someday you should invite all of your listeners here because it's a very interesting looking home.
That's not a bad idea. One day maybe we'll do a contest where like come sit through the podcast.
No, but I mean everybody, not just one.
Oh, everybody.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea.
Just get some traffic and charge them a buck. You'll do very well.
You know, people always talk about web traffic. This is literal traffic.
Walking through your house. And don't tell your wife. Let it be a surprise.
No, she'll love it. Yeah. She loves...
Honey, what's the line outside? Oh, did I not mention?
I forgot to tell you 200,000 people were showing up.
But it's a buck ahead, honey.
Yeah,
so,
you know, I mean, I don't know if we should split that because it was really my idea.
That's
but
true.
You know what? I'll take you to a nice dinner and everything should be fine.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
All right.
And all right, man, thanks so much.
All right, enjoy your burrito, everyone.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.